Good evening. The Naples Council on World Affairs is pleased to present a lecture by Dr. Dalia Dassa Kay, Director for the Center for Middle East Public Policy and a Senior Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation. She is going to speak to you this evening about a, quote, nuclear deal for Iran, prospects and challenges for the United States and Israel. Our timing for this presentation is right on target, as Dalia Dassa Kay will tell you. We hope you will join us for this interesting lecture.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be here. I am just so impressed at the enthusiasm of this organization. Even in cold, dreary places, it's hard to get 750 people in a room. But, you know, for you to leave sunny, beautiful Naples and the golf courses and beach to come hear a talk about Iran, which is not the happiest of conversations, though I'll try to make it as optimistic as I can, is really just impressive. So what I want to do in this bit of time today is I'll talk for a little bit and then we'll make it interactive and open it up for questions from you all. I actually, in contrast to typical RAND PowerPoint style, which we tend to just inundate people with slides, I actually only have a few maps that I'm going to periodically refer to during this conversation. Mostly just going to talk to you today on the issue of the nuclear negotiations with Iran. And in particular, I'm going to cover really three specific areas. Judy was saying I'm going to let you know what's going to happen. We'll get to that. But before we get to what might happen, it's important to understand why we got where we are today. So what I'll do is I'll start with why are we seeing these significant negotiations between the U.S., our Western allies, China, and Russia, the permanent five of the U.N. Security Council, and Germany negotiating with Iran in such a serious way. Why did we get to that point today? So I'm going to start with that basic question, and then I'll move to the issue of why these negotiations, despite the fact we've gotten much further than most of us might have predicted, why they still might not work. And then finally, I'm going to conclude with the question, what happens whether it succeeds or fails? You know, what is the implication of these negotiations depending on how they turn out? So that's just a preview of what's ahead. As Judy suggested, though, while my talk is going to mostly be about these nuclear negotiations, everything in the Middle East connects to everything else. So while I'm talking about Iran, other countries in the region are going to come into play, other pressures in the region. And so that does give you an opening, not completely radical questions, but when we get to Q&A, feel free to ask about the multitude of other issues going on in the Middle East. I can tell you my job as director of Middle East Public Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. I'm based in Santa Monica, so I get my share of sun. But I can tell you it is not a boring job. We are living through dynamic times when it comes to Middle East politics. It's hard to wake up in the morning and look at the newspaper and not see incredible changes in front of us. So there's a lot to make sense of, and I'll do my best with this group today. So starting with why are negotiations going on now? How did we get to this point? I would say there are three main reasons, and I'm going to start with the U.S. side, move to the Iranian side, which I'll spend the most time because I think that's been the biggest shift, and then get to the strategy that I think, you know, it's hard to say there's a successful strategy in the Middle East. It's such a hard region, but I think we may actually be seeing the makings of early success. So starting with the U.S. side, and this is pretty brief, but I think it's clear to everyone that President Obama came into power in 2008, and he was interested in a deal with Iran. And by the way, this wasn't particularly new to the Obama administration. The second Bush administration actually started to reach out to Iran in terms of discussions about stability in Iraq and other things. So this had already been in place. There had been a rethink about how to engage Iran in the region. So Obama came into office, and, you know, he had this rhetoric of an outstretched hand and so forth, and was kind of suggesting if you guys are ready, we will rethink this whole adversarial relationship we have with this country. Unfortunately, a year later, there was an uprising in Tehran, the so-called Green Movement, an uprising on the streets, particularly dominated by youth and women. And it was a real challenge to the authority, and it was brutally suppressed. So with that suppression and the growing repression that Iran faced during those years after, really kind of quashed any hopes for the U.S. to really engage Iran in a serious way. But now you're back to a situation where there may be a better opening. In fact, the U.S.-Iranian relationship reads like a tragedy. It's like when one side's ready, the other side's not ready, and vice versa. We may actually be at a point where the timing may be ripe. So what you have now is the U.S. facing a region where you have this shift of power in Iran, which is the second major factor I'm going to spend some time on. But what that has done is it's led to a U.S. rethink in our overall regional strategy where Iran has been elevated to a higher priority. Now, we can get more into this in Q&A of why this is the case, but essentially, the U.S. regional strategy has three priorities at the moment, and this rethink really started last summer and is well underway. The three priorities are a deal with Iran, a nuclear deal with Iran, the Arab-Israeli peace process, solving once and for all the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which John Kerry is actively attempting to do, and three, containing the disastrous conflict in Syria, which is having spillover to the entire region. I'm going to be focusing on the priority number one, but essentially what we see is with the Middle East in such turmoil, with 3 years of unrest following the so-called Arab Spring that started a few years ago, basically the Obama administration's looking at this region. And you know things are really bad when you turn to Iran to be the good news story. So it's all relative in the Middle East. So it looks around the region. It says, look, we can't influence anything in Egypt. We're blamed no matter which side we support. This is really internal transformations going on. So where can the U.S. make a difference? And the thinking is a deal with Iran could really be a game changer in the broader region. So that's number one reason I would argue why we're seeing serious negotiations today is because Iran, from the U.S. perspective, is a higher priority, and this is an administration that already came into office inclined to try to make deals with Iran. But the most important, I would say, the second factor, and probably the most important factor of why the two sides are sitting at the negotiating table, is the Rouhani factor, is the election of President Rouhani last June. Now, the people that he's brought into office with him, particularly Foreign Minister Zarif, who is a very well-respected diplomat and well-known, in fact, to many of us at RAND. We actually hosted him at a conference at RAND in 2007 via video conference. He was Iran's ambassador to the UN at the time. Some of my colleagues at RAND negotiated with Foreign Minister Zarif after the Afghanistan conflict to negotiate a post-Taliban regime, so a system, a government in Afghanistan. So we know these people a little bit. And one thing I want to make clear, Rouhani and his team, while they are certainly an improvement to Ahmadinejad, the very hardline president of Iran who took power in 2005, until this election last June, while he is certainly a pragmatic force, he is not necessarily a moderate. And I think this is very important to understand. The Green Movement that I referred to earlier that led, you know, that rose up in 2009, that really were considered true moderates that wanted real reform within Iran, they were really suppressed, and they still are suppressed. They're still mostly under arrest, either house arrest or in prison. I actually just saw reports this morning that one of the leaders, Karoubi, might have been released. It's still murky, so that may start to change. But essentially, the Green Movement leaders, the real reformers, are still pretty much marginalized within Iran. But Rouhani and his team, while they're not necessarily moderates, and again, if you look at domestic issues, there's been as many executions or more since Rouhani took office in Iran as there were in the previous year under Ahmadinejad. So we're not talking about dramatic transformational change. But these leaders are different. They're serious. They're pragmatic. And they want a different relationship with the West. And most importantly, they are not willing to pay the same price to pursue a nuclear capability as the previous leaders. And that's where why we have room to work with. The most significant thing as well about, one of the most significant things about Rouhani and the new leadership of Iran is that unlike previous reformers like Khatami in the late 90s, Rouhani seems to have the backing of the supreme leader of Iran. And the supreme leader of Iran actually calls the final shots when it comes to decision making. So the president has significant authority, but really needs to be backed by the supreme leader. Remember, this is an Islamic republic still. And it seems for the time being he has that authority. And the reason he has this authority, and here we need to spend a little bit of time on the domestic situation in Iran, because I think if you don't understand these domestic vulnerabilities, you're not going to understand why Iran is interested, I would argue, I think is interested, at least in a nuclear deal. Maybe not a broader accommodation, but at least a nuclear deal. And, you know, while there are the perception, there's common perceptions out there, I would say conventional wisdom, that since the Iraq War in 2003, that Iran is this rising power in the Middle East, and it's trying to project its hegemony all over, not just in its neighborhood in the Gulf, but all the way to the shores of the Mediterranean, whether it's in Lebanon or Gaza. Here I'm just going to illustrate a map kind of so you can look at a picture for those of you just listening. I have a map up that really, shows Iran and its border states. And the idea is that Iran, after 2003 and the removal of Saddam Hussein, which was a Sunni-led government in Iraq, after they were removed, the idea is that Iran and Shia-majority country was expanding its influence again, not just in its near neighborhood in the Gulf, but even as far as Lebanon and Palestine. But I think the reality, and this is what's important to understand, the reality of Iranian power is much more complicated. And I would argue in many ways, a lot of Iran's policies stem from its insecurity and vulnerabilities. Okay, so it's a little bit against what the conventional view of Iran as this dominant power. And trust me, Iran is a important regional country with lots of ambitions, and it does plenty of nasty things. And believe me, at RAND, we spend time looking at many of the nasty things that Iran may be up to, especially its Quds force of its military that provokes instability in other parts of the region. But Iran also has a lot of domestic vulnerabilities. And especially in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, starting a few years ago, when Iran was looking around, not only did it survive its own uprising, the Green Movement, but it's seeing leaders toppled all around them in the region, and it recognizes, if anything, Iranian leaders are rational and they are interested ultimately in survival. They're pragmatic and interested in survival. And if you're pragmatic and interested in survival, you're going to look around this very dangerous region and all of the demographic, economic pressures that are surrounding it, that Iran is not immune to, especially when you have a youth population of over 60% of the Iranian population is under 30 years old. And these are people who are educated and have no job prospects or very few job prospects. 70% of those unemployed in Iran are youth. And these are the kinds of pressures, it's a complex story of the Arab Spring, but these pressures of educated, young populations with very few prospects, in employment, frustration with personal freedoms, frustration with corruption, growing gaps between rich and poor, where those with a vested interest in the Islamic Republic are doing very well, driving luxury cars, other people can barely buy anything in the supermarket. You know, this is creating a lot of discontent within Iran. And so the leaders are aware of these domestic pressures, and this is combined with the effect of sanctions. You can pile the two together, ineffective economic policies of Ahmadinejad, growing demographic pressures, and the really, really strong hit that Iran has taken from unprecedented, not just U.S., but international U.N. security-based sanctions that had pretty much cut off Iran's ability to export oil, stopped its banking, its finance system. It's led to the Iranian currency falling by half, stopped half, at least half of its exports, major inflation. So you're really having a very, very vulnerable domestic environment. This is what Rouhani, when he was running for office, this is the environment he faced. And in many ways, the reason why he ultimately came to power was because people want a change. They're fed up with this situation. And to make matters worse for Rouhani and any current Iranian leaders, they're not just facing these domestic pressures, but they're facing a very, very difficult regional situation. The Iranian leadership has supported Assad, President Assad's Syria. Now, Assad is affiliated with Shia and Alawite sect. If you look at Syria, 15 to 20% of the Syrian population is Shia. It's a minority population, minority-led government ruling over a majority Sunni nation. Iran has a vested interest in propping up the Assad regime. It's an ally. It has taken a tremendous hit in the broader region by doing so. Its ideological appeal to the broader Sunni community, and if you look at this chart, this map, and it's a map really showing the divide between Sunni and Shia in the region, you really see the majority of the Middle East is Sunni. So being a Shia-led power and trying to play sectarian politics is not exactly going to be in Iran's favor. Typically, Iran has tried to speak past sectarian tensions and try to suggest it's the leader of the broader Islamic world, fighting the resistance movement, the leader of the anti-West, anti-Israel, and so forth. So it has taken a serious hit in its ideological and regional appeal by backing the brutal Assad regime and its suppression of the Sunni minority. And I think it's no surprise, a recent poll, for example, Zoghbi poll, of 20 Muslim-majority countries showed Iran's approval rating plunging from 75% in 2006. Now, if you recall, 2006 is when there was the Israel-Hezbollah war, and Iran's support for Hezbollah is very popular in the broader region. So in 2006, Iranian popularity, whether it's Sunni or Shia, was at a high, okay? Majority of people in the region, Sunni or Shia, was very favorable towards Iran. Today, its approval rating is at just 25%. So you really see a plummeting of Iranian popularity. You see this growing domestic pressure, both because of economic policies and sanctions and the demographic pressures that Iran is facing. And it is no surprise that this context led to President Rouhani coming to office, the more pragmatic faction, the supreme leader realizing for the legitimacy and survivability of the Islamic Republic that he would have to back this actor to try to accommodate the pressures going on. And this explains the context of why we see the Iranians sitting at the table. And it's very important to understand this because factional politics and who leads Iran matters. Rouhani and the people around him do not want to pay the price that previous Iranian leaders have paid to pursue a nuclear weapon. Now, we can argue in an official Iranian policy, they're supposedly not pursuing a nuclear weapon. I think most of us understand that that is suspicious at best based on previous activities. But who leads Iran really matters because, again, because these leaders want to survive, because they are pragmatic, Rouhani and the people around him are taking a very different approach, and I think there is an argument to be made. They are very serious about actually coming to a deal. I think the other issue that's very important is for the time being, because Rouhani has shown at least initial success, we have this interim agreement that was negotiated in November, just started January 20th, that for the time being, he has marginalized more hardline forces within Iran who are not interested in a deal in the West, who are not interested in accommodation, and who are interested in paying whatever price is necessary for a nuclear weapon. Luckily, those hardliners do not have the upper hand right now. The problem is they're still there. They're still there. And so this is why this is becoming a real test And Rouhani's going to have to really show he can deliver if he wants to continue having this upper hand. And finally, I think one could argue the third reason why we see negotiations happening today is you finally have a strategy that is not just pressure, not just engagement, but a really comprehensive approach combining pressure with engagement to get the other side to the negotiating table. I think there's no question that the vast international sanctions, and because they're multilateral, that's really why they've made a difference. When they're just the United States, it's not effective. But when you have the entire international community isolating Iran, the Iranians pay attention. So that has really helped. But just pressuring Iran without offering them an alternative, an off-ramp, you know, here is, if you accept this deal, here's going to be the benefits, and we're serious about that. It's very hard to see the Iranians having been willing to come to the table. I think there's still mistrust, but I think they believe they may have a better future by putting a hold to this program than moving forward. And the reason I think it's very important to understand this is there are some, and it looks like this congressional sanctions push is on hold, but there are some in Congress who drafted a bill saying, even with this interim deal, let's just put more and more sanctions on Iran, right? Let's just keep hitting them hard because that's the only thing that's going to get them to the table. But the point is, it's not just hitting them hard that's getting to the table. It's showing that there is a strategy where if they accept a deal, there's a better outcome for them. And the reason this is important is because you're actually facing an opponent, an adversary, who one could argue, based on previous positions and polling, is not going to just capitulate when it comes to the nuclear program. We need to be very realistic about this. The Iranians are going to bargain hard, and they're going to bargain hard because if you look at the map and you see where Iran is located, they're in a pretty dangerous neighborhood. And you can make the case that any Iranian government, and don't forget, the nuclear program in Iran started before the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979 and has continued under all kinds of different leaders in the Islamic Republic. And if you think about it, if you're a country in the Middle East and you see countries that gave up their nuclear weapons getting attacked, like Libya, and the leaders toppled, and you see countries that have acquired nuclear weapons, like North Korea, who still manage to remain in power, what lesson are you going to draw? So, you know, there is a case to be made that there is a strong strategic deterrent reason any Iranian leadership would want a nuclear insurance policy. And so this is why I'm suggesting we can't be naive about it. This is going to be a hard negotiation. What makes it even more difficult is the nuclear program has tremendous support among Iranian people, even among more moderate secular types, because of these security considerations. In fact, RAND did a poll. It's not that easy to do polls in Iran, but we did do a survey in Iran some years back, and we found 43% of Iranians were in favor not just of a nuclear capability. And we could get to that in Q&A if anyone's confused about the difference between a capability and a weapon, but they're different. 43% were in favor of Iran having an actual weapon, a nuclear weapon. Now, this was some years back. I'd hope the number would look different with negotiations in place. But a very recent Zoghbi poll showed actually that 96%, nearly any Iranian you talk to, are extremely supportive of, quote, maintaining the right to advance a nuclear program, unquote. Now, this would presumably mean a peaceful civilian nuclear program, which is what Iran is claiming that it's after. But this is very, very important, because if you are pushing for sanctions legislation that's calling for the dismantlement of all Iranian civilian capability, dismantling all its infrastructure, dismantling its ability to ever in the future be able to acquire a nuclear weapon if need be, that's probably going to be a deal breaker. This is widely supported across the political spectrum and among the population. So that's why I argue that while we're going to have to bargain hard and really try to get a deal that keeps Iran from the point where it could quickly break out to a nuclear weapon so that the international community would have enough time to know it's happening and do something about it, because that's probably the best we're going to get, and we need to get a very effective deal in terms of inspections and so forth. But we're not going to get a deal that's going to say Iran destroys everything it's worked toward for decades in its nuclear infrastructure. We're just not. So that, I think, sums up why we got to negotiations, this combination of the U.S. position, the domestic Iranian environment, and a strategy combining incentives with pressure that actually is working. So we got this far, which a lot of people were surprised about. Why might it still not happen? And this is probably an easier question, because the harder question is why it happened to begin with, given this adversarial relationship and mistrust and so forth. But I do think the intentions on both sides are real. But it may still not happen. Why? Well, the main features of the interim agreement are going to be the contours of what any final agreement is going to look like. So what's happening now in negotiations is the United States and its allies signed this agreement that went into effect last month, January 20th. It's a six-month agreement. It's going to expire July 20th. My guess is it's probably going to be extended. And while the negotiations for a final deal are going on, basically the interim agreement froze Iran's program in place. And this is very important because with decades of sanctions and isolation of Iran over the past decade, Iran has continued and continued and continued to expand its nuclear capabilities. So in 2003, when Iran first suspended enrichment, it had under 200 centrifuges spinning uranium, which is one path to a nuclear weapon. Today, it has nearly 20,000. This is with all our threats of force, all of our international sanctions. With no deal, one could imagine this trajectory is only going to continue. So the point of a deal, an interim deal, is to put the pause button on so that Iran can't use negotiations as a time to kind of accelerate what it already has. It has to stop what it's doing, and we need to talk business. What does a final deal look like? Well, the contours of a final deal, it's kind of like the Israeli-Palestinian peace settlement. We know what a deal is going to look like. It's just how do we get there, right? So it has four main elements, the interim deal, and I think the final deal will as well. One is going to be limiting Iranian nuclear uranium enrichment. So the interim deal did that in a pretty significant way. The 20% uranium, this gets a little technical, I'll stay out of the weeds, but just generally speaking, Iran agreed to dilute its uranium that was at 20%, which can get to a bomb-grade level much more quickly than lower levels of enrichment. They agreed to get rid of the 20%. So right now, during the pause period, Iran cannot enrich above 5%. So a final deal is going to have to limit uranium enrichment, but it's going to have to limit it much more than what this interim deal did. It's going to have to neutralize the plutonium reactor that Iran has in Arak, because there's two ways to get a nuclear weapon. One is uranium enrichment. The second is plutonium. And we have to watch out for both when it comes to Iran. The third is going to be intrusive inspections, the famous Ronald Reagan, you know, trust but verify. So the interim deal has led to daily inspections of Iranian nuclear facilities. A final deal is going to have even more rigid, strict, intrusive inspections. And finally, the interim deal and the final deal will have to have sanctions relief. Interim deal, I know there was a lot of controversy about this, it did not give Iran significant sanctions relief. It gave it some. A final deal will have to give it significantly more, and it will have to give them relief on the core banking, financial, and oil sanctions that are in place. So what's going to stop a final deal? Any four of these elements, right? I mean, is Iran prepared to dismantle and roll back its uranium program, its plutonium track, and allow the kind of inspections that's going to make the United States, our allies, be able to sleep at night and not worry that Iran is going to break out to a nuclear weapon? It's not clear. Is the United States and our allies going to be able to relieve, be able to to actually deliver on our end of the bargain with sanctions relief. It's no secret that Iran is getting sanctions in Congress against Iran is not a very tough initiative. So, and I think it's going to be very, very tricky to get the kind of relief and the level of trust that would be necessary. And you need the U.S. Congress to play ball on this. So this is all going to be very difficult. And finally, you're going to have spoilers on both sides. You have vested interests in Iran that are not in favor of Rouhani and his cohort, who are part of really radical revolutionary forces within the Islamic Republic, who have actually benefited quite a bit from the current leadership, and are worried and fearful of engagement with the West, because ultimately they think that's going to be the end of the Islamic Republic, right? Opening up the doors to the West, opening up engagement. And if you look at the Soviet Union, if you look at any other country that did that, you know, they may have a point. A lot of people argue over the longer term, that's actually going to be a threat within. And then you have some regional neighbors and, you know, Saudis and others who are anxious about a Western deal with Iran. I wouldn't say they're going to sabotage it. I think they'll be resigned to it. But they're worried about a deal with Iran because they're worried that's going to, you know, U.S.-Iranian relationship improving will come at the detriment of their own relationship with the United States. And then finally, I think in my title that they advertised, the word Israel was in there. So we'll get to the Israel factor. And here I think you have a complex situation. But I think it's important to just take note of Israel in particular because they have a real vested interest in the outcome here. I was talking at lunch to a group and saying how actually for the majority of people in the region, you know, while we consider Iran the number one national security challenge, for most people living in the region, it's really their own survival and Syria and the spillover from Syria that's keeping them up at night. But Israel is an exception to that. Iran is still threat number one, concern number one for most Israelis, or at least Israeli leadership. So they are very, very concerned about these negotiations and the outcome. The official Israeli position, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has not been shy about this, is that Rouhani is what he calls, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing, right? This is all just kind of a cover, and Rouhani is just, he looks nicer, he sounds nicer, but it's really the same bad guys in their turbans that we've always been facing from the Islamic Republic, and really this is no change, and what's going to happen is they're going to play on the West and act as if they're ready for these big changes. They're not going to change everything, and meanwhile, the West is going to get a horrible deal, and Iran will go ahead and still weaponize and get a nuclear bomb. So the Israeli position has not been shy, official position has not been shy in being very opposed to even the interim agreement. What I think, though, is important for American audiences to understand, because you're not always, you know, reading the Israeli press and some of the more nuanced views going on, and I wrote a piece about this, actually, in the LA Times not long ago. There are Israelis in the security establishment, especially military and security establishment, who actually are quite critical of Netanyahu's position on Iran. Not because they also don't mistrust Iran. They do. They're worried about this. But they feel his very public, belligerent stance in opposition to the deal really created friction with the United States. And what Israelis really dislike more than Iran is a prime minister who's stirring up the pot with the United States, because ultimately that's Israel's most critical ally. So that's a no-no in Israeli politics. And a lot of people thought he should have done it behind closed doors and that Israel was just isolating itself, and what it was doing is really not underscoring that Iran is an international problem, not just an Israeli problem. So when the Iranian delegation was the only one that walked out when Rouhani gave his UN General Assembly speech, or one of the three, I forget the other two, but they weren't parties that you'd probably be proud of being with, were the only ones to walk out of the room, that really underscored Israelis' isolation on this issue. What's interesting is that the Munich Security Conference that just took place, I understand that Bogi Yaalon, Israel's defense minister, actually sat in the room in the front row when Foreign Minister Zarif gave his talk. So obviously, the complaints within Israel about Netanyahu's approach, I think, have been heard. And I think Israelis are reassessing their kind of knee-jerk opposition to this. And they're taking the approach or starting to understand, let's see how this plays out. You know, before we just, you know, negate that this interim deal is going to do anything, let's see what a final deal would really look like. And let's bargain hard and make sure that our allies understand our requirements, what we require for a final deal. So I think you see Israelis, again, they're not always in the press, they talk more quietly, but you see some Israelis who do not take the maximalist position of Prime Minister Netanyahu, which is total dismantlement, who understand that a deal with Iran will require some minimal Iranian enrichment. The problem is even these forces in Israel, who may be more accepting of a U.S.-Western deal with Iran, they may not ultimately think that the final deal we can live with is something they can live with. So that's going to be a real difficult factor that we're going to have to work through when it comes to a final deal with Iran. Now, will they attack Iran? And this gets to the final issue of what are the implications of a deal working or a deal not working. So starting with a deal not working, let's start with the positive. And then we'll end with, or then get back to the positive. We'll start with the positive. Let's say a deal works. Let's say we actually succeed, the U.S. negotiating team succeeds with our partners in achieving a final nuclear deal with Iran. My prediction is this is not going to happen by July 20th, which is the six-month deadline. It's probably going to get extended. But let's say negotiations are looking fruitful and they end up succeeding. Well, it's going to be, I would say, not necessarily a game changer, but a big boost for broader regional security. Don't expect the Iranians to play nice in areas like Syria because they still have a vested interest in Hezbollah. They're still going to cause problems. But let's just say, with a nuclear deal, you're more likely to be able to cooperate with Iran on areas where we actually have some common interest, like common animosity toward al-Qaeda, because al-Qaeda is as big a threat to Iran as it is to the United States, counter-narcotics, other kinds of areas where we actually have some agreement with Iran. That's going to be more likely in a post-deal environment that succeeded than one that failed. That said, I think we have to be very cautious in our expectations. A lot of people are talking about this as a Nixon goes to China moment, or this will be a game changer such that U.S.-Iranian relationships will completely transform. I'm more skeptical. I think there's a good reason to believe that even if you get a final nuclear deal, you're going to get actors, first of all, there's going to be hardliners within Iran trying to sabotage it. Iranian moderates and pragmatists are going to show that they still are protecting national interest and may double down on areas like Syria and their support for Hezbollah and the Quds Force just to show that they're still a player. So they actually may become more difficult in other areas. And then you have the problem, which is it's not going to erase all of the other reasons that the United States sanctions Iran. Its support for terrorism, human rights, and its approach to Israel. And all of those sanctions are not going to automatically be lifted because we have a nuclear deal. So again, I think a nuclear deal would be a better outcome, but it's not going to maybe lead to the transformational dynamic that some people are suggesting. That said, if a deal doesn't happen, it's even worse. So in the Middle East, it's all about what's bad and what's even worse. It's very, very rarely, what's great. What would be worse than that limited nuclear deal, which would be a very good thing to solve, would be no deal at all. Because no deal at all, I'm not one to think it's going to be doomsday. I actually think both the U.S. and Israel would be very cautious in attacking Iran for the same reasons that we haven't militarily engaged Iran to this point, which is that a military solution is not just risky, but is very questionable in terms of whether it can achieve our objectives without making the situation worse. There is an argument that actually a military attack on Iran will be ineffective in destroying its capabilities and will even make it more inclined to rush toward a nuclear weapon. So for those reasons and others, I think a military option is still going to be probably not the preferred choice if a deal fails. But what we're going to be back to is where we were before this deal got underway last month, which is shadow war, isolation, Iran doing really nasty things, and the potential for escalation at any moment between Iran and Israel, especially when it comes to Hezbollah, because any tension, even if it's not nuclear related, could lead to escalation. So I think, again, I think while a nuclear deal isn't going to solve all the problems of the region, it's certainly a better outcome than the very, very bad outcome of no deal at all, where expectations were raised, then they were diminished, and then we get to the point where if we don't have military conflict, we certainly are on the road to escalation that could lead us there, which, as we know, nobody really wants these days. We've just fought two and a half, if you count Libya, wars in the Middle East, and nobody's particularly enthusiastic about yet another war in this region. So I would argue the prospects for a deal are as good as they have ever been in over a decade. They'll be difficult. They're not going to solve everything, but they're certainly better than the alternative, which is no deal at all. So I'll end with that. Thank you.
Will you please come up to the microphones if you have a question? Okay, we'll start over here with the first question, and then we'll just alternate.
Dolly, you've done a great job of analyzing the situation in terms of how we got here and where we are, and I agree with all of your conclusions. This almost follows on the previous answer that you just gave. You indicated the best we can hope for is to freeze their position in place. That begs the question, what is their position? If they have, in fact, already developed a weapon, as some people think, or if they're extremely close, as the Israelis think, they would have an incentive to go ahead and enter into an agreement because it would be virtually meaningless in terms of preventing them from getting the weapon.
Right.
So how do we really know where they are? And if we don't know, is it worth the risk?
Yeah, good questions. Well, let me be clear. When I said mentioned freezing and putting a pause, that is what the interim agreement does, and in fact even rolls back the program to some degree in terms of its 20%. One of the reasons I was suggesting a final deal is going to be difficult is because Iran would have to give much greater concessions than just freezing, and that's how we would know, right? This is what would give the West our insurance policy. They would have to roll back significantly the number of centrifuges they have, the quality of their centrifuges. They would have to neutralize their plutonium reactor, either turning it into a light water reactor or destroying it altogether. It is very hard to see. Forget about Israel's bottom line. There is no way any U.S. administration and our allies, the French are actually even tougher when it comes to nonproliferation than the United States, there is no way that any agreement with the West is going to allow Iran to keep the level it has now because everybody agrees they're just too close. So a final deal, whether it happens this July, whether it happens 6 months after that, it may never happen, but if it happens, it's going to have to significantly roll back the program. It's going to go way further than what the interim accord did. So I think that's what would be the insurance policy.
Over here, please.
I understand there is a United Nations resolution that calls for a weapons of mass destruction, a destruction-free zone in the Middle East. Do you think that a successful outcome of the current negotiations would mean a big step towards that objective, as it would put pressure on Israel now to give up its weapons because there is the argument is void that they need to defend themselves?
Yeah, that's great. You guys are really a sophisticated audience because I've written quite a bit on this issue of a weapons mass destruction free zone and NPT negotiations and so forth that most people, their eyes glaze over. They know nothing about it. So I don't want to have everyone's eyes glaze over answering this question, but it is a good one, and there is no question that there is growing, I wouldn't say pressure, but growing focus on Israel's capabilities in the context of Iran. I wouldn't just say in the context of Iran. Don't forget, if Syria destroys its chemical weapons arsenal, Libya, according to the New York Times today, has just been revealed that its chemical weapons arsenal has been destroyed. Let's hope Syria's becomes destroyed. This question of removing all weapons of mass destruction, biological, chemical, and nuclear, is no question going to become higher on the agenda of the region, which is a good thing. The issue with Israel is really tricky. I find it very hard to believe, and for those who don't follow it, it's the worst kept secret in the Middle East about Israel's nuclear capability. Official U.S. policy still doesn't acknowledge it. It's taboo to talk about it in Israel. So I'm just referring to reports of Israel's nuclear capability, which is assumed to be, according to reports, fairly significant, probably over 200 warheads. Israel is the only, according to reports, known country in the Middle East to have nuclear weapons capability. The Israelis view this as their ultimate insurance, right? We talked about insurance policies. Given their history of the Holocaust, their mentality and so forth, it's going to be very, very difficult for Israelis to give up what they view as a key deterrent in their national security strategy. That said, you do hear voices in Israel starting to raise questions. They're not official voices. They come more from academia, but those debates are probably going to become more prominent if there's a nuclear deal with Iran, saying, does this make sense anymore for Israel? Why do we have nuclear weapons? We have the greatest conventional force in the Middle East. We can wipe out any Arab Air Force. We can wipe out any combination of forces in this region. We have the backing of the United States military. Some people argue they eventually could be part of NATO and get that umbrella. So people in Israel are starting to raise that question, but I think it's going to take time. And I think there's also those in Israel who are suggesting, why are we so opaque about this policy? That's what it's called, a policy of opacity. They don't acknowledge they have nuclear weapons, but they also don't deny it. And people are arguing, well, if we have them, let's just, and especially if we're not sure about Iran, even if there's a deal, we're still going to worry that they're going to break out. Let's make it very clear and register very clearly what would happen should anybody think about developing these capabilities and announce in a more overt way our capabilities. So I think you're touching on a debate that hasn't happened yet, but I think it's very likely to be triggered by the combination of things going on, the nuclear deal, the chemical weapons development in Syria, and so forth.
Okay, over here, please.
Could you please elaborate on the risk of trusting Iran, particularly if they deceptively develop a nuclear weapon and the imbalance that it would cause in the Middle East and the race by other countries in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia to develop a weapon?
Okay, good. So I think there are risks. I think there are less risks if you have a deal than if you don't. As it is with this interim deal, there are daily, this is a new element, not just weekly or monthly, but daily inspections of Iranian nuclear facilities. A final deal will be even more intrusive. So the best way to ensure Iran isn't cheating is by watching them. And so I think we have better chances of doing that with a deal than without a deal. If a deal fails and we don't get an intrusive inspection regime, I would be much more worried about Iran secretly breaking out to a nuclear weapon, or even not so secretly. In terms of why this is such a problem, which is really what your question is asking, you know, and I talked to someone about this earlier at lunch, you know, why are we so worked up about Iran having a nuclear weapon? Does it matter? You know, should this be the priority of the United States to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran? And there are a lot of people who argue it's not such a bad thing. You know, you've got, the high school students are gone, but, you know, in college you study realism and Kenneth Waltz and, you know, people who believe proliferation is good and stabilizing and deterrence is stabilizing and maybe Iran would balance Israel and it would lead to stability. I am in the camp that is not so alarmist about a nuclear-armed Iran, but I I'm still in the camp that believes we really have to prevent this, but not necessarily for the reasons that are often portrayed. So some of the reasons people argue, as you had suggested, is because it would set off a regional arms race, particularly with the Saudis and then possibly the Turks, Egyptians. I am not as worried about that. I certainly think it's a risk. I think the Saudis, while, you know, there are arguments that they could go the Pakistani route and buy a Pakistani bomb, you know, the Saudis are not going to quickly depart from the United States, the broader Western international community, by bolting to a nuclear weapon. It's not going to be that easy of a thing to do, and it also creates some vulnerabilities for them. So I think that, you know, there'll be a lot of attempts and a lot of policies by the U.S. and others to really dissuade our partners from moving down that path. I also don't worry that if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, they're crazy, you know, mullahs, as people like to say, they're going to push the button and destroy Israel tomorrow. And unfortunately, you had Iranian leaders with that kind of horrible rhetoric. I don't think, and most people who know Iran and study Iran well, ultimately, these are leaders interested in survival. And as we just discussed the reported nuclear capabilities of Israel, there is no way that Iran is going to be able to launch attack on Israel and be able to survive as a country. So I do think that deterrence is likely to work. So those aren't the reasons that I would worry about a nuclear-armed Iran. Why I would worry about it is the reasons a lot in the region worry about it is the concern that it's going to give Iran more influence. That, again, I think, you know, we should be cautious about, because I think Iran already is trying to exert influence even without the actual weapon. But the real risk of a nuclear-armed Iran, and why it should be a high priority to prevent this, is because nuclear weapons are incredibly destructive capabilities. And I think the potential for accidents and miscalculation and escalation are tremendous in this region, where you have countries in close proximity with no communications, with decades of mistrust. You know, there's a lot of rosy, you know, retrospective kind of revisionist thinking about how stable the U.S.-Soviet nuclear deterrence was. Well, you know, I wasn't alive when people were ducking, covering, and, you know, but I think reading the historical record there really underscores how close we came at several critical junctures, even with the Soviet Union, when we had diplomatic relations and a hotline and constant communications, and we were on the other sides of the world from each other. And even then, the potential for miscommunication and accidents that could lead to nuclear use were real. They were real. Imagine that context in the Middle East with the Israel and Iran and Israel's neighbors in such close proximity with no communication, with enormous mistrust. That is not a recipe for stability. So I'm not in the camp that thinks we should just let this go. We definitely have to do what we can to prevent it.
I read an article recently about Secretary of State John Kerry, and one of his hopes for the region, and I'm just asking about Iran in this case, mm-hmm. is that if the economies could be improved, and so that, as you said, so many young people could get employment, that might go a long way. What's the basis for economic development in Iran, aside from oil?
Well, yeah, very good question. It's unfortunately quite an oil-dependent country, but like other oil-dependent countries in the region, if it really wants to accommodate its youth over the longer term, increasingly educated youth and including women, it's going to have to diversify. So Iran is very, you know, has a lot of human capital, as I was suggesting, has probably great potential in lots of technology areas. You know, I'm not an expert on the Iranian economy, but I think there'll be a strong incentive to diversify. Of course, the first thing they're going to do is pump out that oil like mad, and there'll be European investors all over the place. And the Iranian government will do what lots of governments in the region do, which is handouts to their people to kind of keep them quiet. But that only can last so long. So hopefully, and I think there are signs that there are technocratic types close to Rouhani and that leadership that might have an understanding that the economic policies of the past, forget about oil, will have to change if Iran really wants to invest in its future, which means diversifying away from just oil only. But there's no question that opening up engagement and trade and investment will be a big boost to the youth in the country, And in fact, this is why many of the hardliners within Iran are very fearful of a deal, because they're worried about the other things that comes along with that, including potential openings on the domestic front.
Okay, over here, please.
Thank you.
Dolly, I wondered if you would broaden the discussion just a small bit with Iran as the great patrons of both Syria and Hezbollah, and just talk a little bit about why that relationship isn't something that we shouldn't also be worrying about a great deal. Thank you.
Thank you. I absolutely think it's something we should be worrying about in a very significant way. I think that, unfortunately, Syria has become a proxy conflict. It's become a proxy conflict between Assad, President Assad, and his supporters, namely Iran and Russia, versus the opposition forces supported by the U.S., Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and others. The problem is the opposition is fractured, whereas the Assad government is, you know, and its support is fairly unified. This conflict, I was talking earlier about this, is the number one concern for people living in this region. It's not just a humanitarian tragedy, and it is a tragedy. You have over 2 million Syrian refugees all over the region, not going back anytime soon. Very destabilizing for neighboring states like Jordan, absorbing what is basically the equivalent to the United States absorbing the entire population of Canada. This is what Jordan's facing today with Syrian refugees. Dire conditions, so it's a horrible humanitarian situation. And then you have that compounded by a terrible strategic situation where you have all kinds of openings for really, really bad news, extremist actors, Salafist, Al-Qaeda-linked types of groups, really barbaric, really, really barbaric groups who can't be negotiated with, and they are sprouting up all over the region. So Syria is a tremendous challenge. I think the hope is that if you have a nuclear opening, that can at least, it can open the possibility that we could sit down with Iran and Russia and try to figure out a way to walk back support for these opposing sides in Syria. It's going to be hard. Secretary Kerry apparently just the other day tried to raise Syria with Zarif, Foreign Minister Zarif, and Zarif told him, I don't have the authority to deal with that. Because there are forces within Iran, especially the Quds force, that actively trains Hezbollah, who's supporting the Assad regime. There are reports, pretty credible, of Iranian military forces in Syria itself helping prop up that regime. It is, if you think about it, for Iran, Hezbollah is the only successful export of the Islamic Revolution. It's failed everywhere else. There's nowhere else Iran has succeeded. Everybody rejects its ideology. Nobody wants to be an Islamic Republic, not Egypt, not Iraq even though it's Shia, nobody. So Hezbollah is its very, very close ideological and strategic ties. It's not going to cut those easily. The good news, though, is Iran is really suffering a lot by its investment in Syria in terms of its own domestic popularity. It's losing legitimacy over this. And it is very concerned about these Al-Qaeda actors, too. So what we need to figure out is how we can find some convergence of interest to start the conversation on walking back our respective allies on the ground there and at least trying to create some kind of ceasefire, humanitarian corridors, and things of that nature. It's not a conflict that's likely to end anytime soon, though, unfortunately.
Thank you.